You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you know there was a plan from the U.S. government to train cats to spy on the Russians at the height of the Cold War? We didn't either. We'll talk to a historian about some of the outside-the-box plans our government and other governments considered and why they didn't ultimately happen. Now, the number of people going to college is down around the U.S., and in Wisconsin, the UW system recently announced a slight decline, too, with about 3% fewer students overall this fall. Some economists say a lot of that can be blamed on the country's growing economy and low unemployment. But our next guest says for the long-term story, we need to talk about America's declining birth rate. Justin Fox wrote about this. He's a business columnist for Bloomberg. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
We've talked some on the show recently about these numbers happening now. You, in a recent piece, look forward about 10 years. What can we expect to see when it comes to our college enrollment?
Basically, for it to nudge up probably through 2025, 2026, and then it's just downhill all the way after that, although it really varies a lot by institution. Like in Wisconsin, the UW-Madison is still growing and adding students. It's the regional campuses that are going down, and that's pretty much it's identical to what's going on in definitely other Midwestern states and probably a lot of the rest of the country.
Now, you point out in your piece that it can be tough sometimes to predict what's going to happen in college enrollment when you look at demographic trends and enrollment trends. What are some of the things that have hung us up in the past?
Well, so after the baby boom stopped booming, there was a lot. There were going to be suddenly a lot fewer 18-year-olds in the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. There was going to be a big drop-off, and so there were some dire predictions of this was going to be terrible for colleges. What happened instead is enrollment rates just skyrocketed, and more people went to college. Then there were these projections in the early 90s that as the millennials started going to college, there'd be this huge demand for professors and such. And the millennials did go to college. Enrollment went up a bunch, but and they did hire professors, but they were mostly adjunct jobs. There wasn't much of an increase in good professor jobs. And there's sort of infamous book written in the 90s that I supposedly convinced some people to go into get PhDs, and they're still bitter about it.
There's gold in them, our academic departments.
And exactly.
Turned out there wasn't.
Yeah, and so now the books that are coming out now are like the one that I rely on very heavily in one of these columns I've written is by Nathan Graw, who's an economist at Carleton College in Minnesota. And you know, he says in the book, I would not advise looking for a tenure-track position at a U.S. university in the late 2020s. So that's one warning out there.
And people have pointed toward nowadays, we've got this economic recovery. We're past the worst effects of the Great Recession. People are maybe able to get jobs without much education that they wouldn't have 5-8 years ago.
Yeah, and that's why the regional campuses and two-year colleges, to some extent, are getting hit harder by that temporary, you know, business cycle effect. Because, yeah, there were lots of people in 2008 through 2012 or so who maybe didn't really want to go to college, but they weren't going to be able to get a job anywhere, so they went. And I think a lot of those are trying the labor market instead.
And that can be good news for now. But in another piece you write, long-term, if people aren't getting an education, and that doesn't necessarily mean a four-year degree, but if people aren't getting post-high school education, that could be a problem down the road. Why is that?
Just that if you delay it, there are ways, and there's lots of people in the U.S. higher education system talking about ways to make better pathways from you work a few years, you go get a certificate in something, don't go off 4 years to college, but get a certificate in something useful, and then go back into the workforce at a slightly higher level. But that just doesn't happen a whole lot, and there is evidence that basically the longer people delay any kind of higher education, it has negative effects on their long-term earnings.
Talking to Justin Fox, business columnist for Bloomberg, looking at a couple pieces he wrote on the future of college enrollment. After about a decade or so from now, people are expecting it to go down potentially quite a bit. Justin, you say that could be a time and a reason to maybe shake up higher education in a way that benefits students more. What would be a positive way to approach this hypothetical downturn in the number of people in college?
Well, so what happened a decade ago was there was a ton of college-age kids coming out of high school, and a lot of them wanted to go to college because the labor market was bad. And at exactly that time, states were cutting funding to higher education all over the place, which is somewhat understandable because they were going through budget struggles in the recession. But it just created this perfect storm of awfulness for people who are now in their late 20s, which is sort of the largest age cohort in the country, who are stuck with lots of student debt, were at universities that were a little bit overwhelmed. So if you look at it, flip it in the other direction, if you're going to have this smaller group of kids coming out of high school, and you know, hopefully the economic situation for the states will be better, and they won't. And for the past few years, they have not in general been cutting back on higher ed. They've been increasing funding. So one can at least imagine that maybe one way that especially junior colleges and regional campuses find to survive is to find ways to serve these kids better and be more flexible and maybe be cheaper if there's a way to do that and get some bits of higher education to more people, not necessarily four-year college degrees for everybody, but a little more training, steering people into careers, other things. And at least, you know, the demographics are in favor of that because these places are going to have to do something. So maybe they'll be creative.
If we're going to see a decline in the number of college students in, say, a decade or so, are we already seeing this happening in our, I don't know, kindergartens and elementary schools?
Yeah. I mean, the National Center for Education Statistics keeps track of how many kids are in every grade. And I'm trying to remember exactly, I guess the decline, I think there are a lot of 12-year-olds, and then it starts declining at 11, 10, 9, and gets lower after that. And you know, that can be affected a little bit by immigration, but since immigration has been going down lately too, in general, the elementary schools are already being hit by this.
Part of the problem in predicting college enrollment is how do we know who's going to enroll? One big factor is a kid is apparently more likely to end up going to college if their parents did, too. How does that all affect these trends we're watching?
Right, and they're getting to be more and more, a higher percentage of kids are in that situation. So, and this is Nathan Graw at Carleton, that's kind of the gist of his approach, is trying to look at the demographics of kids who will be getting out of, the parents of kids who will be getting out of high school in the coming years, and make projections about how many will probably be heading on to college. And I mean, the problem, so I think the percentage he thinks will keep going up a little bit because of that. The problem that a state like Wisconsin faces is just, you know, they're fewer and fewer. There's going to be a rise for the next couple of years, but then after the high school graduating class of, I guess, 2025, it's just downhill all the way unless a lot of people suddenly decide to move to the state. And so, again, the main campus in Madison will probably be fine because it attracts lots of people from outside the state, and so faster growing parts of the country will send their kids there, but that's not going to necessarily be happening at all the regional campuses.
And one last note, Justin, I think it was one of your pieces you write. Yeah, there might be fewer college students out there. It's not going to get any easier, though, to get into Harvard.
Yeah, because that's one of the, and this is, again, Graw's projections, but I think it's also just borne out by what we all see, is you're going to have more and more kids nationwide who meet the profile in terms of who their how much money their parents make, how much education their parents have, that they're going to be trying to get their kids into elite colleges. So that one group is actually not going to be shrinking, even as the number of high school seniors in general will be shrinking.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Justin Fox, opinion columnist at Bloomberg. He writes about business and economics with us today to talk about why college enrollment is expected to go down in a decade or so, big time here in the United States and in Wisconsin. Coming up, from nuking the moon to spy cats, the United States government has entertained some unusual ideas as part of its intelligence and military history. We'll get a rundown on some of the ideas that didn't make it off the drawing board. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get a rundown of some of the biggest cases being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court, including a look at DACA and a non-look at a gun lawsuit. Now, you all remember that fateful day in 1958 when the U.S. government sent a nuclear bomb to the moon as a show of global force. Wait, you don't remember that? Well, that's because it never happened. But the idea of nuking the moon was considered by the U.S. military back in the 1950s. It's just one of many unusual plans the U.S. military and intelligence agencies have considered over the years. Plans like training cats to spy on Soviet officials or unleashing glow-in-the-dark foxes in Japan during World War II. Our next guest shares some of these plans and why they were ultimately abandoned. Vince Houghton is a historian and curator for the International Spy Museum. He's the author of the new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I really appreciate you guys having me.
When people talk about intelligence history, military history, they often focus on the things that did happen. What led you down this path for these plans that didn't quite make it off the table?
Well, I think it's not just intelligence and military history. I mean, I think history is just full of books about things that happened. I mean, that's kind of a truism. And I set out to say, you know what? Let's write a book about things that didn't happen. And a lot of it was, I kept running into these stories doing research for another book. And they just were so good. They're just so wonderful. And it felt almost like the stories had to be told regardless if they had an ending or not that made us kind of feel good about ourselves. And as I was doing the research, I started realizing that it didn't really matter if these things happened or not, because historically, understanding the intent of some of these very important historical figures was just as important as if these things actually went through. So it helps us to understand a lot about the people at the time. I'm always someone who argues for being empathetic about people in our history. That's the way we can learn from history. And there's no better way than kind of getting inside the heads of people when they're making ridiculous decisions based on fear and desperation.
And that's a key point. You say there are two ingredients in a lot of these plans that now sound really wild. Desperation, you just mentioned, and innovation. What happens when we bring those two ingredients together?
Yeah, well, trouble. I mean, I think that in 2019, we look back at these plans and we kind of laugh at them because they're ridiculous. But if you put ourselves in the shoes of the people at the time, we can understand a little bit better why these ideas came up, because this is the Cold War. This is World War II, where we truly had an existential threat. And I think that word gets overused and bandied about, but a threat to our existence that we just don't really appreciate as much today. And so when you put together that desperation with very creative people, scientific geniuses, we're talking like Carl Sagan here, then you're going to get some really wacky ideas. And that's really what this book is all about.
Now, there are some things that everybody's going to, I think, key in on here. The nuking the moon idea, the cats we might get to, the spy cats. Here's the one that struck me, and I'll go here on a selfish level. This is World War II, desperate time, war with Japan in the Pacific, and the idea comes to unleash foxes that have been painted in glow-in-the-dark paint.
Right, yeah. So
what?
Well, this is, I mean, anyone who studied a little bit of World War II will remember how racist America was toward the Japanese. And part of this was believing that they were not necessarily subhuman, but at least not as advanced as we were. And so the belief, the ridiculous belief at the time, was that they were extra superstitious, that the Japanese would be cowed by mystic and religion and stuff. So the idea was, let's tap into this, use psychological operations to freak the Japanese out. And part of the Shinto religion with the vast majority of the Japanese are foxes. And foxes tend to be kind of evil spirits in Shintoism. And so if you could paint them with glow-in-the-dark spray paint and then drop them into Japan ahead of the Marines, then the belief was that the Japanese soldier, who wasn't afraid of dying at the hands of the Marine, may be frightened away by a glow-in-the-dark fox and run away and surrender instead of fight. There's a lot of problems with this. One of them being the kind of ethnocentrism of the idea in itself, but at a more practical level, is you actually have to insert these foxes onto these islands the same way the Marines did. That's in the water. And although in the 1940s we did have a way to make glow-in-the-dark paint, We didn't have a way to make waterproof glow-in-the-dark paint. And that's one real hiccup that came along. And it took all the way to General Douglas MacArthur to say, hey, what happens when all the paint washes off? No one underneath MacArthur, a five-star general, decided to say, hey, maybe this idea won't work out great because of the whole water thing involved in it.
Did we get to the stage of actually painting the foxes here?
Well, we did a full-blown test in Central Park in New York City. And we dropped glow-in-the-dark foxes, no warning whatsoever to the poor New Yorkers. And it had the intended effect. There were New Yorkers running, screaming for the exits because of these spirit foxes running around the park. And there's a wonderful newspaper story the next day about them running, using very 1940s terminology, like running out of the park like screaming jimmies, whatever that is. But it seemed to work enough that the U.S. government thought it had a winner on its side.
Well, it's a good thing then that the enemy didn't come up with this plan because it worked on New Yorkers.
Right. Yeah. No. And I mean, if you think about New Yorkers who every single day deal with sewer rats the size of dogs, these foxes must have been terrifying to make New Yorkers run screaming.
We are talking to Vince Houghton from the International Spy Museum. You can hear him, by the way, on their podcast. It's called Spycast. His new book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Let's go, if you don't mind me spoiling the title one a little bit, the plan to blow up a nuclear weapon on the moon.
And this is one where it really exemplifies the concept of what the hell were they thinking from a 2019 perspective, but in 1958 and 59, understanding it completely. This comes right after Sputnik, where the United States and the West is terrified that the Soviets not only have built a rocket that could launch intercontinental ballistic missiles, because that's really what Sputnik has launched in space on, but also that they've demonstrated to the Third World, which is the battleground of the Cold War, that they have outdone us in science and technology. They beat us into space. And so the United States Air Force decided it needed a show of force that would at one time show the whole world that we were the big kids on the block. And the idea was, let's detonate a multi-megaton thermonuclear weapon on the moon. Now, you might assume that there was some tinfoil hat-wearing scientist at the bottom of the Pentagon who concocted this plan. Actually, he is a guy named Leonard Riefel, who's not a household name, but he later on becomes the deputy director of the Apollo program. So this is a real scientist who studied with Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago, who later on would create
Madden would draw the thing. He invented
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why I can't think of the name of
Telestrator,
it.
Telestrator?
Right,
something like that.
Telestrator, yeah, I'm sorry. So for weathermen and for sports. So this is a real scientist. He actually brought on a geologist named Gerard Kuiper, who you may have heard of the Kuiper Belt, mm-hmm. which is on the outskirts of the solar system. And Kuiper and Riefel had no intention of doing the math that was necessary to do this because they were full professors. And as you know, professors don't do math. They brought on the young grad student. And the grad student's name was Carl Sagan. So these are some of the most prominent and successful scientists of the 20th century that were going through this idea about detonating a nuke on the moon. And of course, it doesn't happen. And the wonderful thing about intelligence history is that we don't always have all the answers because documents sometimes don't exist anymore, or they're heavily redacted, or they're still classified. And so there's no real great reason for why this program was canceled, at least as far as I am satisfied seeing.
Right. There are people say, well, we think it might have been they're worried about, you know, radiation or this or that. But there's never a we're killing this program because of this that we can find.
Well, certainly there's no smoking gun or smoking nuke that says that we're going to stop this program because we probably shouldn't detonate a multi-megaton thermonuclear weapon on the moon. Not a single person seemed to say that. And really what I think it is, if you remember, if you've watched any of the early footage of the American space program in 1960, 1961, so we're talking about 2 or 3 years from this time, of all the rockets exploding on a launch pad, or flying up maybe 20 yards before they turn around and come back down, or turning sideways and going out into the ocean. That's with no people on there. That's with no payload. But imagine a 5-megaton nuke on top of one of those. That would be really problematic if one takes off for the moon and lands instead in Miami or Albuquerque or anywhere, or Madison, Wisconsin, just because we are so behind in our ability to put rockets into space. That's probably why the Air Force decided this was not a good idea.
Let's spend our last couple of minutes on another Cold War story, the Spy Cats.
Yeah, so this is a program called Acoustic Kitty, and I'm not making that up. That was the actual CIA code name. So someone at CIA had a sense of humor in the 1960s, and this was relatively genius. The idea was cats, stray cats are around the world in major cities. The Istanbul is a great example. There's stray cats everywhere. And no one pays them a lot of attention. Or if you do, you'll love cats. You scratch them behind the ear, you know, you'll pet them a little bit. But you won't stop your conversation when a stray cat walks in front of you. And we decided, what if we could get a covert listening device inside one of these stray cats? And I don't mean just kind of put it on a collar around its neck. The idea, and what we actually did, was take a cat and bring it to a veterinary suite and surgically implant a listening device inside the cat. The power pack in its abdomen, the antenna up into its tail, and the microphone up into its ear canal so the ears could actually filter the audio coming in from whatever conversation we're trying to figure out. And what the amazing part is, the technology worked. The cat, when it was all sewn up and woken up, it actually could do its job. It was a walking listening device that was created by CIA. Now, the trouble, of course, is you got to train your cat to be an effective listening device. And I think anyone who's been around cats for 30 seconds, that's where the plan starts to fall apart. And you can probably sense that's where CIA probably should have seen that coming. And so the most popular realistic story behind Acoustic Kitty is that they were unable to train it, and so they canceled the program. But there's another version that Acoustic Kitty was happening at the same time as another CIA program called MKUltra. And MKUltra was a mind control program that a lot of people know because of the LSD work that was done during this time, but it was much broader than that. And part of it was trying to figure out, can we control the minds of animals using electronic stimulation? And so the Acoustic Kitty story was that they couldn't train it, so they went back in and they rewired the cat's brain. They got rid of the instinct to get hungry, got rid of the instinct to kind of wander off and lick itself, and turned it into a actually controllable animal, at which point they brought it out to do a full field test of Acoustic Kitty. And that's where tragedy struck. And I can give away the end of the story, but it's absolutely exactly what you expect to happen. They brought it to Washington, D.C. on the streets. They were going to test it. They put it down on the street, hit their spy button, and it ran off in the direction of two guys sitting on a bench, got halfway across the street, and got run over by a taxi cab.
We'll leave it there, Vince. Thanks for sharing these stories with us today.
Of course.
That's Vince Houghton. His new book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Plots Left on the Drawing Board. He's with the International Spy Museum. Stick around. More to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins Kate Archer-Kent for a look at a variety of issues facing the city, from traffic to lead to preparations for a big political convention next year. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments in some 50 cases for its upcoming judicial term. Among the cases being considered is a challenge to the Trump administration's decision to end an Obama-era program aimed at creating a path to a legal status for young people who are brought to this country illegally as children. It gives them protection from deportation. The nation's highest court also announced today that it will not hear a case on a lawsuit against a gun manufacturer. There are other cases in the works, too. Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're not going to hit all 50 cases, I'm afraid, Charlie, in our conversation here. But is this a pretty big and significant chunk of litigation coming before our high court here?
It is. I mean, they had a couple of lean years, in part because we were negotiating and navigating the death of Antonin Scalia and then the addition of a couple of justices who were somewhat controversial to the public and to members of the Senate. So I think we finally got a court that settled and has an agenda, what kind of cases they want to take. And so we've got some sort of mini blockbusters coming up. And one of the interesting things is some of them, I think, are really going to animate the public in the upcoming election next fall.
Do we have a predictable court on a lot of these high-profile issues?
I don't think we do. And we're waiting for some data about the way we see some of these justices voting. We do have some pretty good information about how they're likely to vote because of the way in which they behaved as members of lower courts. So both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, you know, we have a record. But it's different when you get to the Supreme Court because there's no place else for litigants to go. You know, you are the last stop on the bus line. And so there's a different weight to every question that comes to you because there's no backstop. And so I think you're going to see some differences from what we expected from justices on particular cases. And I think just labeling a justice conservative or liberal does us a disservice because we don't really get to see the nuance in their interpretive approaches, their ideology, and their legal education that's really going to drive the decisions in these cases.
You mentioned that elections are coming up next year. Some of these decisions will drop next year in the heat of election season. Is there ever a reluctance from chief justices or justices in general to do something that might really sway an election?
We have some information. I think one of the most prominent is likely a 1992 case that many people might be familiar with, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which was at the time the blockbuster abortion case. There were a number of people who believed the court was ready to overturn the right to privacy as it applied to women and to abortion. And at the very last minute, there was kind of a negotiated agreement among three justices that gave us a different doctrine, but still allowed women to pursue that right under law. Chief Justice Rehnquist was somewhat animated in his belief that they should not take this case right before the 1992 election. It came to the court anyway, and it had at least some impact on the way people were viewing the court and the way in which the next president would help shape a generation of decisions from that high court.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about a lot of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's get to one argued today, Charlie, on DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, saying if you were brought to the nation, there's a lot of rules here, but brought to the nation as a kid, you got a clean criminal record, you graduate high school or you're a military veteran, you are protected, at least in the interim, from deportation. This is hitting the Supreme Court now after the Trump administration wanted to overturn those protections. Bring us up to the case today.
This is one of those cases that if you just sort of read a quick synopsis, you think, oh, this is a case that's going to interest me. I should read the oral arguments. I should tune in. But it's actually in many ways a dreadfully boring case because it doesn't really get to the central issues about equality under law or justice for these individuals. It doesn't even really get to the policy of deportation because it's focusing on a really arcane element of a 1946 act called the Administrative Procedure Act. And the question really here is can the court actually hear this case? Is this a case that they can hear? Because the administration has lots of discretion when policy comes from Congress for them to implement. And here the question is this just a discretionary decision and the court shouldn't have anything to do with it? Now, if they get past that question, the next question is whether or not the decision that they made was legal. And my guess is here is that the court is going to eventually discuss this case and decide the case because they're going to argue that the way in which the administration resolved their understanding of DACA and what the administration currently is saying is it's an illegal program, that they did not have the power under law to make it. That is very likely going to be interpreted by the Supreme Court as wrong. And because of that, they're probably going to look at whether or not they have to go back and justify their decision. So that's a lot of complexity. But in essence, what the lawyers were arguing about today in a subtle kind of tangential way was, is the administration going to own their decision here? And their decision is to get rid of DACA to try to deport people. And they were trying to hide behind an argument that the law itself didn't allow Obama to create DACA in the first place. What the court, I suspect, is likely going to say is, yeah, they had that discretion to do it. Now, administration, are you going to follow through and pursue DACA as a policy or drop it altogether and get rid of the protections for dreamers, as they're called under law?
So it's a little weird here. The executive branch is saying the executive branch under its predecessor overused its power. Usually the executive branch is saying, yeah, we have more power than you say we do.
Exactly. I mean, they're saying of Obama administration, you had no right to create this policy. The problem is we have at least two decades of precedent of administration's doing just this and courts approving of it. So it's unlikely that the court is going to say of the Trump administration's decision, you're correct. They're going to say to Trump's administration, you're interpreting the law incorrectly. So tell us whether or not you want to keep the program or not. And that's a purely policy decision by the Trump administration. They don't have to do this. They have the discretion to drop DACA altogether. And that's why those who are trying to protect the Dreamers are saying, if that's what you want to do, drop this policy that protects Dreamers, go ahead and do it, but own it. Make sure you tell the voters that's exactly what you want to do. I suspect that's what the court is going to tell them to do.
DACA was started because Congress couldn't come to an agreement on the status of this particular group of people who are brought over again as kids. They're brought over undocumented and illegally. And President Trump has said, hey, I don't want to hurt these kids at a couple points. I don't want to hurt these people, but I want Congress to fix this. Congress could take this out of the courts, right, by clarifying the status of the people in this category.
They certainly could by, in essence, limiting the discretion of administrations to make this decision at all. They could just rubber stamp this and make this law. They could come up with their own framework, whether it includes a path to citizenship or limiting the people who may stay in the United States. But yeah, it could fall right into Congress's lap. And the president, to his credit, is saying we need some stability in law. And this is his way to try to leverage his power to get Congress to act. The problem is we have divided government right now with Republicans holding one chamber and the Democrats the other, and they don't play well in the sandbox. And because of that, I doubt that they're going to come to any conclusion, even with this sort of Damocles hanging over their head. So it's a threat that may be useful, but at the same time may be empty and not get anything accomplished.
And there was a bipartisan plan in the works in the Senate that the Trump administration held back on and then turned against late in the game. So maybe I guess the lesson is don't hold our breath that something's going to come out of Congress that the president's going to sign on this.
Exactly. I mean, there are conflicting views within the White House and within the administration. And I think there are so many people buzzing in the president's ear that the mixed messages are not creating an atmosphere where they're going to get a solid policy that the administration's going to support and get behind if it comes out of Congress.
Well, I want to turn to another thing that actually came out of the U.S. Supreme Court today, some non-action. The Supreme Court said they would not take up a challenge to something going on in the state courts now. This is a lawsuit from Sandy Hook families, people who lost kids in the Sandy Hook shooting. They want to sue the rifle manufacturer Remington because of the way they marketed their AR-15 Bushmaster rifle used in that shooting. It's in the state courts, but the company brought it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court says, no, thanks, we're not going to touch it. What does that mean?
So this is an interesting case, too, because, of course, there's an act at the federal level, the Protection of Lawful Commerce Arms Act, that says that, for the most part, gun manufacturers have limited liability for the use of their guns in criminal activity. And it's created almost this blanket protection. Except there's this weird little loophole in the law that says, yeah, but if a manufacturer violates a state or federal law regarding the sales or marketing of a product, then under unfair trade practices laws, they might be able to get sued because it has nothing to do technically with the use of the gun, but how the advertisement of the weapon might have created an opportunity for somebody to use it in an appropriate way. So this tiny little slice may allow the Sandy Hook litigants to actually bring a case and win in court. And it doesn't really get to the actions of the shooter itself, but to the manufacturers and their actions in advertising it. And for those who have been pursuing gun manufacturers, and in sort of a side note, the NRA as well, what this does is allow them to pursue discovery. That is, getting into the files and information held by these companies and expose them to public light. So even if they lose, I think to a certain extent, they're very happy to be able to get into court and drill down into this information and share it so that the public understands what gun makers might be doing. Now, gun makers might believe that there's nothing untoward in that information, but it's that opportunity for litigants today.
This is going to take place now in state of Connecticut courts. The U.S. Supreme Court said this isn't a matter for the federal courts to intervene in, at least in this case. Could that these ads appear all over the world? Could this open the door for other state court challenges, lawsuits over the marketing of guns that the federal courts now wouldn't touch?
Exactly. I mean, it's an area we call new judicial federalism. If you can't win in federal court, you go to state court and try to use the similar kind of law that the state has passed. So in this case, it's the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And by leveraging the protections in that act, they can go to court in Connecticut. And if there is a similar kind of law in other states, they might be able to replicate this litigation all across the country. Now, of course, in some states that might have looser laws or more protective laws, you're going to get different outcomes. But at least it's a model that other individuals might use to get at these kinds of issues. Now, again, in some red states versus blue states, this might be impossible. But it's a strategy that might work for those who are trying to get at the gun industry.
We're talking to Charlie Jacobs right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. He's with us to talk about some big cases ahead of the U.S. Supreme Court, including a potential ruling on the end of DACA. We also just talked about a case that the Supreme Court says isn't coming before them, this gun lawsuit in Connecticut. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this DACA case before the Supreme Court about how this makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court operates in general? How would you like to see the justices rule? How do you think they'll impact Wisconsin? How do you think they'll impact the elections? Do you vote based on who is going to get to appoint these Supreme Court justices? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about some of the big cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. We took a look at DACA. There are also cases involving the Clean Water Act, gender discrimination at the workplace, and more. Charlie Jacobs is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have your eyes on one of these cases in particular? Do you have thoughts on the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court now? Do you have questions for our guest about how to watch this court, what to expect out of them, what kind of tea leaves we could read? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Charlie, I mentioned this Clean Water Act case. This one's coming, I think, out of Hawaii. It got into some weird territory in the oral arguments about whether pollution that goes into the ground first and then seeps into the water is the same as pollution that goes into directly, say, into a river and then out into a water body. What's going on there?
So, I mean, this is a case that probably will pique the interest of, in particular, rural residents, farmers, because they tend to use septic systems and the like in their containment units on farms and things like that. So under law, there's a distinction between point source pollution and non-point source pollution. And so point source solution would be a factory has a pipe and it dumps right into a river. All the pollution is coming from that one point. A non-point source is something like it rains, it washes oil off of a street, which goes into a stream, which winds up in a river, which winds up in a lake. That's not a direct effect of a manufacturer or a homeowner or the like. That's a non-point source. So in what's happening in Hawaii is there's a waste treatment plant, and it's pumping all of its water into the ground. It's finding its way into groundwater, which is leaking right into the waters off of Maui. And it's affecting the health of the environment around that leak. And so the question is do they have to get a permit from the EPA or not? Maui's argument, no, we don't have to, because it's not a point source. It's getting interrupted by the groundwater. They say, you know, if we're pumping it into the water, sure, we'll get a permit, but here we don't. And the big question is, for those who might have a septic system, does that mean if their septic system leaks and it goes into Lake Michigan, do they now have to get a permit just for their little septic system? And if they don't, the fines can be as high as $50,000 a day. So that's an issue for them. But for others, it's, well, now there's an excuse for people to not ever seek remediation of their pollution and do things like pump it into the ground, or even just lay a pipe up to the edge of the river, but not into the river, and it will transmit into that body of water in a kind of an ambient way. And so this has a real impact on how we're going to interpret clean water laws in the United States and who's going to be responsible for when the pollution makes it into a body of water like a lake or an ocean.
As you laid it out there, both sides are arguing kind of an extreme case. Hey, if you rule this way, this guy with a septic system is going to be paying these six-digit fines. But if you rule that way, companies have a free fire zone to shoot pollution into pipes 5 feet from the waterway. I'm guessing probably we're going to end up somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, It was funny because Justice Breyer was kind of calming everybody down. Like, we'll discuss this. Trust us, we'll discuss it. But, you know, it was funny. I think the funniest exchange that went on was the lawyers from Maui said, you know, this is like if you were going to a party and you poured whiskey into a flask and then flask into the punch bowl, well, you wouldn't say the whiskey bottle polluted the punch bowl. And the opposing attorney got up and said, I like that analogy, except we all agree we want to keep the whiskey out of the punch bowl. Right. So that's the argument they're making. At the end of the day, everybody wants to keep water clean. What's the most effective way to do it?
And there's a lot of humorous anecdotes that come out of your standard oral argument, right?
Yes.
Not really? No? Okay.
No.
We're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court, what's on their docket this term, a lot of big cases. Charlie Jacobs is with us, associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. One that there were arguments on a while back had to do with gender discrimination, sex discrimination laws at the federal level and whether they apply to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender workers. A few cases, I think, rolled together here. What's at stake in this one?
What's at stake is this one is how we're going to interpret a law that was passed in 1964 and try to understand how we're supposed to sort of understand the evolution of language over time, because Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act says that you can't discriminate based upon sex, as well as other characteristics like race. And the question is what did the drafters of that act mean by sex? Did it apply to those who are gay? Did it apply to those who are transgendered? And so there's going to be this argument about whether or not we rigidly try to define what sex is, or there's a more malleable definition of how that applies. So what at base here is you wouldn't fire somebody merely because you're a man or a woman, because that's how we traditionally define sex. But does that law also apply if you're firing somebody because they're transgendered, right? And so, or they're gay, because that's not a typical or what in 1964 would have been an understood meaning of sex. And so that's what's really tying people in knots about how do you understand this term? And are we going to allow it to apply in sort of an evolutionary process where we've understood that term differently since 1964?
This was argued last month. When would we see a ruling on something like that? Do we still have to wait for 2020?
We're going to have to wait for 2020. I mean, there are always a series of cases that are problematic for the court that they want to get right. And there's usually a contentiousness among the justices. And I think this one's going to be really interesting because, you know, we were talking at the outset about how predictable justices are. And I think you might see some justices, especially conservative justices, vote in ways that you might not think. And the reason I say that is there was a case in 1998, kind of similar. This was a sexual harassment case where men were sexually harassing another man. And Justice Scalia wrote the opinion, and he noted that, you know, same-sex harassment can violate Title VII. Just because it's not the traditional way we think of sexual harassment doesn't mean it doesn't count. What he argued was it's a reasonably comparable evil, and that's what the law is trying to stop. And so if you apply that kind of logic and language from Justice Scalia, you might see the same thing, because what the sex discrimination statute is trying to stop is discrimination based upon that kind of classification. And if you're discriminating against a transgendered person, well, that's a reasonably comparable evil. So I think you might see people who think like Scalia, like Gorsuch, they might hook on to that decision from two decades ago and rule that way.
Last 30 seconds or so, Charlie, Chief Justice Roberts may soon have a side gig presiding over, if it goes through the House, an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Can you talk briefly about the role of the Chief Justice in these rare instances of impeachment trials?
Yeah, well, we've only got two, and it's funny. Last time we were lucky because Rehnquist actually wrote a book about it. Roberts did clerk for Rehnquist, so there's a chance that some of it rubbed off on him. But remember, they're acting in essence like a trial judge, and so they're just going to try to make sure that the law is applied fairly, the rules are applied fairly. But most of all, they're just a referee, so he'll probably stay out of most of the political arguments and that kind of brouhaha that you'll see in the institution of the Senate.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Charlie Jacobs, associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. He joined us for a look at some of the biggest cases before the U.S. Supreme Court this session. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, impeachment proceedings will be the big story in national news in the weeks, maybe months to come. A media expert joins us with advice on the best ways for journalists to cover it. You can join in with your thoughts. We'll wrap up the WPR podcast series Derailed and get some behind-the-scenes stories from creators Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden. Plus, we'll visit a Wausau bookstore that just celebrated its 100th birthday and get a look back at its place in central Wisconsin history. That and look at some of the top stories in national politics. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate gets an update on conditions for people detained at the U.S.-Mexico border, then looks at the diversity of immigration here in Wisconsin. That's at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then prepare to disagree. Our guest makes the case for five policy ideas that don't usually get a lot of support in American politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.